As a cinema, it's frustrating when your success is decided by things you can't control. Hollywood hits come and go. What stays the same are the amazing experiences you offer your customers. Whether it's an engaging and successful membership program, seamless seat upgrades, next level food and drink, or extras like arcade games and bowling. But to do this well, you need a POS system that can keep up. Tapos has been developing cinema software for over 25 years. They know what it takes to run a successful movie theater, and they've created a solution that can match your boldest ambitions. Learn more at taposapp.com.
Our job as art house distributors and independent distributors in the US and internationally is to really break people out, to break movies out that don't necessarily look like they're blockbuster movies on paper, but to get as wide an audience as possible for these films in the US and internationally, and also to start careers and to further careers for people. That's the most sort of satisfying element of this job.
This is the Box Office Podcast in its daily CinemaCon 2024 edition, brought to you by Tapos by Jack Rowe. And today we are going to go over everything happening on the first day of CinemaCon 2024. I'm joined by my colleagues and co-host, Rebecca Pauly, deputy editor at Box Office Pro. I have to remember to enunciate, Rebecca. I'm not even in Vegas yet because we're pre-recording this, and I'm already slurring my words.
You'll snap into it. It's sense memory.
There we go. And we've also got Chad Kenrick, our analyst and staff writer here, who is helping us out producing the show from Vegas every day. Of course, this being Monday morning, we are in Vegas, we promise, or at least we hope so, unless somebody missed our flights. But we are recording this ahead of time. We are currently packing our bags, sending meeting requests, interview requests. I'm excited. I hope you guys are too. We've got a great episode for you today. In our feature segment, we are joined by Rebecca. This is an interview you did with an executive from Searchlight Pictures.
That's Rebecca Keary, who is in charge of international distribution for Searchlight. Of course, their big film over the last year, Poor Things. They also had All of Us Strangers. Just a really interesting conversation, I think, about the evolution of how some of these art house films are distributed and marketed overseas, and how that's been challenged and changed over time.
And she's also going to be receiving the CinemaCon Passepartout Award. You can read that interview that Rebecca had with Rebecca from Searchlight in our print edition of Box Office Pro, available in the media stands over here at Caesars Palace at CinemaCon 2024, and available to our subscribers as well. That should be getting to you through the mail this week. It is the magazine with the Angel Studios cover. So a huge, huge thank you to our colleagues at Angel Studios for their support of Box Office Pro. So guys, let's get started here with the schedule. Chad, we've got a packed day. It's International Day, my favorite day at CinemaCon. But that's not it. We've also got some evening events. I think there's a screening tonight. What's going on? When does things start, and how does the schedule look like?
Yeah, things kick off bright and early at 7:45 a.m. with the International Day breakfast, and the program actually beginning there at 8:15 with the international keynote addresses. On the exhibition side, Eric Maniel.
I'll go with that. Apologies to our Belgian friends at Kinepolis. He is the chief box office and marketing officer over at the Belgian multinational circuit, Kinepolis.
Yes. And on distribution side, Veronica Kwan Vandenberg, president of distribution, Universal Pictures International.
And we've also got an award presentation in that International Day breakfast, colleague of ours, that is going to be part of our delegation of French exhibitors that our parent company, the box office company, is bringing to Las Vegas. A big congratulations to our colleagues from Le Grand Rex. Alexander Hellman, the managing director of the Grand Rex in Paris, is going to be there in person to accept the award. Guys, I must tell you, I've been to the Grand Rex multiple times over the years in Paris. One of the nicest movie theaters in the world. You cannot miss it. It's a destination movie theater, bucket list movie theater. next time you're in France.
Yeah, I mean, I've only seen pictures that we have running in our CinemaCon issue, which, as you pointed out, is available for you to pick up. There's a detail in there that I loved is they, was it in the 90s, they upgraded a lot of their tech and became the, you know, premiere experience that they are today, because Luc Besson was like, I'm not going to premiere my film there if they don't upgrade it.
By Luc Besson. Yeah. They're like, yeah,
they did it up to the standard of
Luc Besson. Luc Besson, also an exhibitor, if I'm not mistaken, in France, instead of just complaining, he did something about it. They got together, they upgraded all the installations, and they've continued to upgrade. They've got a new premium large format theater in there that I haven't seen yet. Next time I'm in Paris, I'll try to check it out. So that is in the morning. What else is going on after that breakfast, Chad?
Yeah, slightly later in the morning, how distribution and exhibition are beginning to share data and what they need to do next.
Oh, nice. That's a panel conversation with Laura Ulgott, from the CEO from Unique, is going to be moderating that.
And our co-worker and colleague, Maureen Suttle of the Box Office Company, along with Otto Turton of View International, Lauren Greenavista, and Anne Elizabeth Crotty at Sony Pictures Entertainment. Data, obviously, a hugely important subject and also a daunting one. So I'm excited to gain some insights here.
Yeah, it's going to be an exciting panel. Preceding that, it's going to be a conversation with Walt Hickey, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author and data expert. I believe he's doing this twice on the schedule, if I'm not mistaken. I think this also happens again in the afternoon. You Are What You Watch. Cinemas is a cutting-edge technology. That's going to be a half an hour speech by him preceding that panel that we just mentioned. And then starting at 11:15 a.m. Pacific, another panel, this one moderated by Nancy Tartaglione, the international box office editor over at Deadline, titled Changing Tastes and Changing Landscapes, with panel members Rebecca Keary, who you can hear from in the feature segment of this episode, our colleague Miguel Mied, the COO of Cinepolis, friend of Box Office Pro, Helen Moss, SVP of international distribution over Paramount Pictures. And it's great to have a delegation from Japan coming in here. Toshi Yamasaki, the CEO and president of Toho Towa, also joining that panel later in the morning.
That's why International Day is my favorite. Everyone knows I get really nosy about international markets. I like to know how things shake out. So Daniel, I'm the same as you. I prefer International Day the best, for sure. Though the lunch might be the highlight of International Day itself, because we have George Miller making an appearance, getting the International Career Achievement in Filmmaking Award. Really excited to, later on in Warner Brothers' studio presentation, to see some information about Furiosa, a Mad Max saga. And also, you know, George Miller's just a great filmmaker. So I think it's interesting.
Fascinating man. Great filmmaker. I'm excited. There's a fireside chat during that lunch, during the award presentation. That might be my highlight of the event. I'm really excited to check that out. And then transitioning out of International Day, we've also got things on the general side of CinemaCon 2024. What's that schedule looking like today, Chad?
Yeah, there's a Fundamentals of Presentation Technology, which is a joint presentation with the Cinema Foundation and ICTA. That's happening in the morning and then again in the afternoon at 1 p.m. Really looking at audio, acoustics, projection media, all of that good stuff. And that one actually has a limit of 150 attendees, so you do need to pre-register for that.
It does look to be free. You just need to, no extra money down. You just need to go in and let them know in advance you're coming.
There's two sessions here, right? So if you miss the first one at 10 a.m., you can go to the 1 p.m. session in case it's already filled with those 150 slots in the morning.
Yeah, I'm excited for this one. I need to actually remember to register myself. So mental note, because obviously, Daniel, as you know as well, a big priority for the ICTA this year and then moving forward is to take some of those very techie, technical elements. They know what they're talking about, but everybody else in the cinema industry maybe does not know anything beyond some general terminology. And I think especially now with premium formats, including audio becoming so prominent in the marketplace, that's what this looks to be is kind of a primer to cinema technology for people who are in different areas of the industry.
Yeah. I think that's going to be a great add here to the schedule. So it's not really a general audience session. I think it's a little bit more of an insider-ish session, a little bit more of a hands-on session. And for those folks like ourselves that are always looking to learn more about the industry, how the ins and outs of exhibition work, it's going to be a great opportunity. But then on a more general audience-friendly level, we've got more panels starting at 4 p.m. chat.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to this one. Strength in the Middle, Working Together to Boost Mid-Budget Films, moderated by Michael O'Leary, President and CEO of NATO. It sounds like a really interesting conversation. It's one that I want to hear more about. It's the type of films that I like to see.
Brock Bagby from B&B Theaters, Rebecca Stein from National Amusement Showcase, and then on the distributor side, Lisa Benil of Focus and Alyssa Fedoroff of Neon. Definitely two distributors that know about what they speak when it comes to having box office successes in that kind of mid-range area.
And we're actively working with our colleagues here at CinemaCon to bring you highlights of that panel session as part of our Friday feature segment here on the Box Office Podcast. That pretty much does it in terms of things we have to sit down and take notes on. But the schedule doesn't end there, Chad. What else do we have for the rest of Monday?
Yeah, so later on in the evening, we have the pre-opening reception, and then the gala opening night event, which is Universal Pictures' presentation of an exclusive screening of The Fall Guy.
I'm really excited to see that one. It was got a big presence at their studio presentation and last year's CinemaCon. Not that we will be able to attend because we will be recording the Tuesday edition of this podcast.
Sorry.
So I hope it's good. It looks good.
Rebecca's shooting daggers at me as we record this. Sorry. We have to work.
We got a sponsor.
What are you going to tell Tapos? What are you going to tell Alan? Alan's been nice to us for years. You're going to tell him, sorry, I won't see a movie I can see 3 weeks later? No.
Alan, like, everyone gets Ryan Gosling. You know, who doesn't like Ryan Gosling?
And that is the schedule here on Monday at CinemaCon. Always fun, always exciting. Not going to lie, probably my favorite part of CinemaCon. Always International Day Monday. I also like Sunday when you come in and it's a little bit that summer camp feel, people you haven't seen for a while. You're like, hey, how are you? And then, you know, you get to pass by them 17 more times.
And then by Thursday, you're dead on your feet and you just do that, like, you kind of see each other from across the Coliseum and you do that, like, slow, tired nod. Like, you've shared trauma or shared tiredness,
more,
I guess.
I would say it's more like senior year too cool, right? It's kind of like a, hey, what's up sort of thing. You know, because you've been there for so long. That's how I like to think about it.
But we're looking ahead right now. We have all of CinemaCon to get through, including the run up here. We went through in our last episode, which you can go back and check if you would like to listen to that, also sponsored by Tapos by Jackrow. That's where we went over the studio slates, what films we're expecting to see, what films maybe need the most marketing push. So although the movie talk is last week, this week we are talking about issues specific to the cinema industry that we imagine are going to arise, that in many cases have seminars. There's definitely a lot to talk about in that regard, Daniel.
Yeah, I'm going to put up some of the topics that we wrote ahead of time that I think we're expecting to hear about, whether it's in the panel sessions or in the hallways or in meetings. I think the first thing that we're looking forward to having a better grasp on is the true impact of last year's labor strikes in Hollywood, not only in terms of the box office, but in terms of where are circuits after what was supposed to be a big recovery year. We definitely felt that right after the middle of the summer release of Barbie and Oppenheimer. We thought we'd turned a corner. Turns out we didn't. The release calendar thinned out by the third and fourth quarter. It was a rough end to the year, and it was a rough beginning to 2024. I'm still trying to gauge from exhibitors how they felt that. And it's not the only labor issue coming up. Rebecca, there's been a labor movement, a move to unionizing specific location for major circuits throughout the country in isolated places to a point where, should we call this a trend to unionization?
I mean, I don't, if it's a trend, it's definitely not an industry specific trend. This is something that we saw a definite uptick in last year. Everyone from John Deere to Starbucks were talking about this issue of unionization. Recently, the AMC's location in LA voted to unionize, joining IATSE. Speaking of IATSE, that is the, or that is the group for people that people who actually make the films.
Yeah, the crew, the below the line talent that work on films. Now, Chad, as I understand, you've been keeping track of this story. IATSE is also in talks of renegotiating agreements. There is the threat of another strike, this time from IATSE, which also brings the added nuance here that an AMC location, quite a big AMC location in LA, has now unionized through IATSE as well. Where are those talks right now in late March, early April with the IATSE union?
Yeah, it's too early to comment very much on what this might look like and what the impact will be. What we can share as of right now is a number of tentative agreements have been reached locally on addressing craft-specific issues with the AMPTP during this first week of the IATSE local negotiations. But with that, what's important to note is that the process is not complete until the conclusion of the basic agreement general negotiations. And so that's going to cover all of the issues that affect all IATSE members who work under that basic agreement. So in other words, the local agreements happening right now are just one piece of the overall package that's going to come into play with the general negotiations, and those aren't expected to begin until May at the earliest.
Okay, so we still have quite a bit of runway here to get clarity on the situation, but I do expect to hear more comment on where we are in terms of these labor issues affecting not only exhibition, but like Rebecca mentioned, many out-of-home businesses, whether it's large franchises or smaller companies. We are seeing this drive to organizing.
Definitely going to be a conversation, many conversations, I think, happening behind closed doors. Obviously, it's a sensitive topic, and it's not a situation where one size fits all. But, I mean, there are a lot of other things, you know, tied in with that, HR practices and hiring and all that sort of thing. So that, I think, definitely is going to be one of the major things that we hear scuttlebutt and chatter on this year.
The other big topic I think we're all curious to hear about has to do with the streamers. Where exactly are they? We know that Netflix isn't joining the party anytime soon, but MGM, before they were part of Amazon, had a studio presentation at CinemaCon in CinemaCon 2021. It was a very good pro-theatrical presentation. Last year, Amazon seemed to indicate they were going to go big on theatrical. They had titles like Air, Creed 3 performed very well, a number of other titles. Then there was talk of a big multi-billion dollar investment in theatrical that everybody reported as fact. No one was able to confirm it. Still waiting for it. Still waiting for that multi-billion dollar investment from Amazon in theatrical. What I can tell you is confirmed is that Roadhouse, their latest Amazon release, went straight to streaming on Amazon Prime. So yeah, in terms of what is fact, what is fiction with the streamers, where they are in theatrical, I don't think there's much to expect on the Netflix front. Amazon, I'm confused as to where they are exactly. Apple, last year at CinemaCon, Apple was the big story. They were pairing up with Sony, with Universal, with Paramount to release movies. Have you guys heard anything on the Apple front for this year? Are they done? Was that it? Was it a one-off or a three-off there between Argyle, Killers of the Flower Moon, and Napoleon? I don't know what's going on here.
Yeah, not really sure. I think at least with the Amazon MGM Studios, you've seen, you know, recent hires, Frank Rodriguez, who's a veteran distribution executive from Searchlight, moving on over there. But No, if anyone does have any clarity as to what is going on at Apple, please let us know. It's a fitting, I will say, I think it's a fitting situation for that company to be in, given they can have multiple TV series like into their third, fourth, and fifth seasons, and I have no clue what they are and I've never heard of them.
It's a company that spent 10 years and billions of dollars building a car they never built. That's what we're talking about when we're talking about Apple, right? So again, in terms of the streaming conversation, what they can contribute to theatrical, I'm very apprehensive in building or selling a narrative that our tech overlords are going to buy our way out of this crisis. It is yet to be seen. And I just have not seen enough either from the Amazon side or from the Apple side to say that they are a consistent partner for theatrical.
Put your money where your mouth is. Like, it's CinemaCon, you know?
Yeah.
It's CinemaCon. I mean, you should be there.
It's a great opportunity to go and promote these titles. Apple did it last year. MGM has done it before. I wish we hear or see a little bit more on what those strategies are or aren't. Related to all of this, as we get used to a theatrical marketplace with less titles and release from studios, we are seeing a consistent overperformance from premium large format auditoriums. And that is what I'm going to be looking at specifically when I hit the trade show floor here at CinemaCon in Vegas. What are the new technology offerings? What are the immersive seating providers offering? What are the large format screen providers, the panoramic screen providers offering? I really want to see how that evolution of technology is going, and if there are any new entrants into the space.
I think another component to that, we have seen premium format screens over-index so much with films like Oppenheimer, for example. But I think a factor that is also definitely at play here is the fact that premium large format or immersive seating, any of these premium formats or upgrades, they cost money to install and build. What is the roadmap? What does the plan look like in the coming years as to what is going to be able to be built, what the resources are? We've seen definitely a big uptick in things like the family entertainment centers as well. Another different kind of premium experience, or I guess three or four or five or six experiences in one. So definitely, I think there's the desire on behalf of the cinema industry and of course, a distributor and vendor partners to delve more into this and to really maximize the benefit from it. But again, resources.
And that leads us into, I think, the next big topic that I want to find out more about is what are the resources in terms of development for new builds and renovations? You mentioned family entertainment centers, cinema entertainment centers.
Cinemark's getting into it.
Cinemark's getting into it. B&B just built a supposedly gorgeous new location over in Red Oak, Texas.
More from our friends at Cineplex who have been ahead of the curve on that particular.
Oh, Megaplex. I mean, it seems like every major circuit is going all in on the family entertainment center concept. And even mid-tier circuits are dipping their toe into these waters. I don't know if you guys saw this. Alamo Drafthouse is opening a like themed putt-putt course, like a mini golf course in their first Florida location. I believe it's in Naples. So it's a very interesting sort of expansion of what that Alamo experience is like. Of course, Alamo is known for having themed bars and having a robust experience outside of the auditorium.
There's a big retail component to there.
Exactly. So they're not a stranger to this, and I wouldn't call a putt-putt course a full-on investment into the cinema entertainment center concept by Alamo, but it's not an investment into more auditoriums, right? They are improving auditoriums. They are improving what they've got on there, but they are adding elements here outside of the auditorium and cinema eatery and like the bar food and service side. So it's interesting to see this. I am very curious to see how the cinema entertainment center concept is spoken about and what role it takes in conversations while we're there.
I mean, it's not a golden one, you know, thing that's going to come along and save the industry. It's a big investment, and it's something that, you know, has to keep racking up those profits for years to come, decades to come.
It's a real estate play too, Rebecca. I just don't see family entertainment center or cinema entertainment center concepts coming to major cities. We are in a situation right now where leases are a big part of your strategy. If you're a circuit, making sure you're paying the right amount to stay sustainable, to be a viable business.
The Alamo Manhattan, I mean, they're the site where they are was, I think, originally intended to be like an underground parking garage. It's different for y'all in Texas. You have the space.
leftover space. It's a little different here as we're cramped in New York City. And finally here, wrapping up our conversation on the major topics that we're expecting to hear more from and find out more about at CinemaCon 2024. Concessions collectibles beyond suspicious looking popcorn tubs that we like to giggle about. These things make money. They made money with the Super Mario Brothers release, Dune 2, of course.
The Taylor Swift
release, Barbie, of course. They are being very well marketed. And this merchandising element of the movie-going experience, I have a feeling we're going to see some really unique offerings at the trade show floor. I can't wait for that trade show to open. I think it'll give us an idea on what is going to be offered to our exhibition community, to our operator friends, to make more money. And that's going to be, I think, a big, big part of it. Of course, the last topic that I don't want to get too much into, because we are going to write a feature story on this in a couple of weeks, once we can breathe a little bit, is where cinema advertising is, on-screen advertising. It's going to be, I think, a very renewed year for this part of the industry, especially as we see media fragmentation everywhere else. But that is Pandora's box. I mean, that is part of a whole other different story. So you can read those updates and all our other deep dives into the industry, not only on our print magazine, Box Office Pro, but also on our website, boxofficepro.com, where we have updates daily on everything in the world of theatrical exhibition. Rebecca, Chad, we've got a busy day to plan for. Monday, CinemaCon day one. We'll get right to that. And for our listeners at home or in Vegas, if you're on the way there or between meetings, you can now enjoy after the break Rebecca's interview with Rebecca Keary, the EVP and head of international distribution over at Searchlight Pictures and honoree of the CinemaCon Passepartout Award in this year's edition of the event. That's coming right after the break.
Rebecca, thanks so much for taking the time to speak with us today. I'm super excited to find out more about the intricacies of international distribution, especially with independent films like those released by Searchlight, which maybe are less mainstream and have more challenging content than something like a big studio tentpole type of situation. I mean, you look at a film like Poor Things, it has sex, it has like medical gore. I imagine there's stuff in it that would make it challenging to market in certain overseas markets, definitely. Can you talk a bit about how you approach that? I mean, you're distributing to all these different markets with different likes, different cultures. How do you approach that? It's not a one-size-fits-all situation.
You're right. Different territories react very differently to different kinds of movies. Mm-hmm. For Poor Things in particular, you know, we obviously there are some markets we're not releasing. So the Middle East, Southeast Asia, censorship always throws up some interesting conversations for us. We haven't cut the movie. So there are certain parts of the world where we're just not really going to even release the movie. Mm-hmm. And then different sort of cultural kind of touch points work well for certain movies and not for others, etc. But obviously we started our campaign for Poor Things at the Venice Film Festival. It went on to win the Golden Lion, which was phenomenal. The Italian press at Venice were very, very positive about the movie, as were all the press that came out of that festival with great reviews. Mm-hmm. But it's overperformed in Italy. It's been number one at the box office for 3 weeks in a row. It's overperformed in Greece, obviously Yorgos's own country. Uh-huh. And Latin America has been phenomenal. Mexico, Brazil, and Argentina, and all of the other countries in Latin America have done really well with it. And it feels like a very maybe it's a Southern Europe or like a sensibility that's a very sort of like Latin sensibility in a way, where it's this kind of artificial world building that really sort of ticks, you know. It's like I was saying to somebody the other day, it's not like London could have ever produced Salvador Dali, right? It's imagination, right? It's imagination, the fantastical, the sort of creation, the really deeply creative side of this film that's really clicked in certain in certain markets. So it's doing really, really well everywhere. But that's just a sort of particular cultural note, maybe on that movie that's really kind of clicked.
Yeah, I know. Comedies especially can be difficult to translate. I mean, it's
oh, absolutely
it's weird to classify Poor Things as any one genre because it's
definitely
funny, but it is funny. So
I would say sharp humor, anything that's kind of what you would consider like black comedy or anything that's satirical, that tends to work well internationally. The Favourite again,
worked well
internationally, and did obviously the UK was huge on that. That was a very sort of a UK driven movie in a way, but that kind of very, very sharp, acerbic kind of comedy or dark humor, that can work really well. The harder sell, I think, internationally is very kind of mainstream, perhaps American comedy, which is a lot tougher. That works well in Australia to some and the UK, but it's harder to translate as you go further in.
What have been the challenges? I mean, in terms of marketing, I imagine all the difficulties that have popped up over the last few years with regard to you're not able to get talent out traveling to a lot of places because of COVID strikes and all these things. Marketing budgets, I feel like, at least on the exhibition side, you know, there have been cuts to marketing teams in a lot of cases. How is what are the challenges internationally? I mean, it seems like over the last, even just year with the strikes, it would be pretty difficult. I mean, because Emma Stone was so integral in the promotion of Poor Things. Like, she was just in the trailer talking as herself.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Emma is a producer on the film. She's obviously the star of the film. But, you know, she was absolutely integral. I mean, I got your talking points, and I just made some quick notes this morning that I can go through. But you're right. I mean, marketing teams have been cut. You know, they're sort of consolidation amongst the studios. And probably the streamers too, in terms of what they're doing. I noticed that American Fiction isn't even dated for release, right? I mean, outside the UK, it's not even dated for release theatrically, as far as I can see. Same with Saltburn, that was UK and Australia only. Those films aren't being theatrically released across Europe. So that's kind of, you know, that's not great from a theatrical perspective, because those are really interesting movies that I'm sure there is a theatrical audience for out there in other territories. But what I would say with the challenges is, what we try and do is, obviously, festivals are very, very important for us in the US as well as internationally. They still attract, the bigger ones still attract national press, international press, the big press outlets that we need to report on the movies and review the films. So that actually starting in Venice was really, really key for us. And then we, across after Venice and into release, we started releasing really in January, end of December, January, in international. And we went we took the film to 40 plus international film festivals. So we go to all of the local film festivals that happen through September, October, November, and December to keep everything alive in terms of profile for the film, getting in local academy members to watch it on the big screen so they're not watching it on the portal. They have the chance to watch it on the big screen first. Mm-hmm. Just trying to make sure that we're creating as all-encompassing a sort of theatrical and big screen environment for the movie as possible. Local festivals allow us to do that. I would say actually creating the elements of the campaign, you're referencing the trailer with Anna. You know, we put out trailer materials ahead of Venice, and then obviously we dealt with we had the SAG strike, so we wanted to we were going into Venice without our actors, and so we wanted to make sure that we were creating materials where Emma got the chance to speak as the producer and the lead, because she wasn't going to be able to be there. So you know, that kind of those kinds of materials were very important in the run up to actually showcasing the movie at Venice. Mm-hmm. And then that kind of dictated sort of the follow through as well, because the strike didn't end as quickly as obviously we wanted it to or thought it might. And so we were in this position where we were working with limited materials involving our actors from there on in. But again, the festivals, the local ground game was very, very important to us. And we had these phenomenal, obviously you've seen the film, it's got incredible scope, but we had HODs, heads of department, who are out there trying to kind of help us pitch, you know, the movie and its scope in as many different ways as possible. And they all were in Venice, which was great. We had them on the Venice press panel. But then we had them again at London Film Festival, and they came to New York Film Festival. You know, so we kind of used the tools that we had that we could use for press, and provided press with the kind of probably a deeper background than they have on many other movies, because we were in this sort of strange environment where we didn't have actors who were able to talk about their acting in the movie. So press really bandied around you know, the technical crafts and what that meant, and it just so happens that Four Things is firing on all cylinders when it comes to technical crafts. So it was really it was a sort of unique and strange environment, but it actually worked really well to sort of set the ground for Poor Things.
I was speaking with Frank Rodriguez a few months back, I think before he moved on to, I think, Apple, was it?
Yeah. He's gone to Amazon.
Amazon. Well, I knew it was one of the A1s.
Yeah.
And he spoke a lot about, you know, how important both the festival market is for Searchlight, and then also award season is
and award season part. Totally award season, you know, it's sort of a little bit of an industrial complex, but it does elevate for movies that don't have, you know, $200 million marketing campaigns stacked against them, or even $150 million marketing campaigns stacked against them. It allows us to work publicity and it gives us it just gives us multiple opportunities to kind of recognize what's great about these movies in a way that, you know, a huge blockbuster Hollywood movie can do it in a weekend. Our lifting is longer and harder, but it's more of a sort of almost like a collaboration with the press. It's like a really great relationship with press when it comes to this season, because you're able to promote all of these fantastic things about these movies in not just trade press but also consumer press, and have really consumer press enter the conversation as well, which ticks a lot of boxes for people who aren't paying attention to the trade, because of course why would they, but they're regular cinema goers who, hey, maybe they did just read about something in USA Today or New York Times or LA Times or BuzzFeed or whatever it is that they're watching and reading, that awards season gives us multiple chances to get to just a general cinema goer, which is great for us.
Even more casual moviegoer. I mean, like on paper, something like
Slumdog
Millionaire, The Shape of Water, you know, they're not starring huge A-list names, or at least not huge A-list names at the time.
Right.
You know,
right.
It enables you to really get some of those bolder ideas out there in front of people.
Yeah. I kind of see it as our job in a way. I mean, I've always worked on the art house side of the business, but that, you know, our job as art house distributors and independent distributors in the US and internationally is to really break people out, is to break movies out that don't necessarily look like they're blockbuster movies on paper, mm-hmm. but to get as wide an audience as possible for these films in the US and internationally. And also to start careers and to further careers for people, because that's the most sort of satisfying element of this job is to introduce, as you said, a casual moviegoer to a movie that they might not have even heard of, and get them to start coming and come back to these art house movies and really enjoy the experience, and then watch people's careers grow. From these movies.
Go back and watch all the previous Del Toro films and love all
right,
them.
Right. I mean, you know, really, really, you know, watch Yorgos's other movies and watch Emma's other movies. And hey, maybe there's someone who's seen this film who isn't aware of everything else that Mark Ruffalo has done, and they may go back and, or Willem, and they may go back and like look at other movies. That's part of the ecosphere that we love promoting alongside just, you know, trying to get people through the door to see our movies.
I know you were with at Searchlight with Frank Ring, right? Very, very beginning for
right.
you in there, right?
Exactly. So Searchlight started 94, 95. Mm-hmm. Really, it started in 94, but first release was in 95. I came as a marketing coordinator, assistant coordinator, in 95, and there were probably 7 people at the company at that point. It had been started by Tom Rothman, and we were based on the Fox lot in LA. And then my working visa, did a graduate degree at USC, and my working visa ran out after a year and a half. So I had 2 choices, which was stay and get another job for a company that would sponsor me, or go back to the UK. And at the time at Searchlight, we were working on some really great British movies as well. Or I say British movies, but movies with big British elements to them. Stealing Beauty, Bertolucci's movie, was one of them. Mm-hmm. And the producers on that film, Jeremy Thomas and his company, said, you know, like, wow, the UK is about to get this lottery financing into the film industry. It's a really good time to come back if you thought about coming back, because the UK is about to go through a production surge. So I went back and I became a film sales agent, which is a very different job from being in a studio. You know, you're kind of really independent, and you're putting films together, but you're selling them to the international marketplace as well, and the US marketplace. So you're literally taking films to the markets and the festivals, creating materials, and then selling them to like a Sony Classics or an IFC or a Searchlight. We saw Bend It Like Beckham to Searchlight, for example. So then I became like the...
So you really have to get to know how to speak the language of what
right.
these particular companies, what these particular
what
companies
buying,
want.
Right, yeah. and what the price points are, and... who do they have their pay TV deal with, and what's their backstop, and how much they can afford, and why aren't Germany buying right now? Oh, it's because they've had a because the pay TV deals have all run out, or whatever. You know, you begin to really get a really great sense of the whole marketplace, the independent film non-studio marketplace, and then to cut a long story short, I ended up coming back. I did another gig in LA for a year halfway through, but I ultimately came back to work for MGM United Artists 19 years ago. Mm-hmm. When Chris McGirt was running it, and Bingham, I don't know whether you remember Bingham Ray, but
just
he was
just the award that's named after him.
Yeah, he was right with the Frank Gott. He was an incredible independent distributor over the years, and he was working at UA. He basically hired me, but then he got fired. But I came back anyway to LA to work on the last year of MGM UA before they sold to Sony in 2005.
One of those. And then you went, ended up at Surgeon.
So I was at MGM UA for a year. We had a great movie called Hotel Rwanda, mm-hmm. With Don Cheadle that we released. Was a phenomenal movie to work on. We had a lot of other movies too, and we basically handed them over to Sony. Capote was one of them, mm-hmm. With Philip Seymour Hoffman. I had my marketing campaign, and I just basically handed it over to Sony Classics, and then went back to Searchlight. And I'd started at Searchlight working on the domestic marketing. I was a domestic marketing person, US marketing. Mm-hmm. And then when I came back the second time, I went and started running their international for them.
You mentioned the, you know, having to be familiar with and gaining familiarity with the entire cinema ecosystem. Obviously, in terms of festivals that include streamers, that marketplace has changed so much since Searchlight started. And I feel like we went through that period where just a ton of money was being dropped at festivals and tapered off a little bit. Does that impact you on the international side so much? I mean, or had just...
It does. It felt like there was a 10-year patch. We're still kind of in the trail end of that. Mm-hmm. 10-year patch. Great example is when Amazon bought Manchester by Sea, mm-hmm. at Sundance, which was a film that we absolutely loved, mm-hmm. but couldn't compete on the price point for. There's Sundance, in a weird way, Sundance is kind of in the eye of the storm as a festival for this, because there are very few festivals where movies show up with the world available to buy. By the time you get to Cannes, a lot of territories have been chipped off, because that's the way some of those films get put together with pre-sales. Same thing in Venice, but Sundance really is one of the festivals where you can still find worldwide rights or a lot of rights still available. Mm-hmm. So it became the kind of festival in the eye of the storm in terms of streamers. You know,
they were kind taking of, things off the board real early on,
really overpaying, distorting the marketplace, and working to a different set of financials from everybody else. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we run numbers all day long. We're looking at revenue streams all day long. What can justify an acquisition price here? What can justify a production price here? All of that kind of stuff.
Have that tech money.
When they really want to go for it, it's very hard, pretty close to impossible to compete.
Mm-hmm. But then, you know, they get the film and. Do they do marketing for it? Do they just kind of dump it? What happened with Apple and Coda? I'm like, you couldn't find that anywhere. It was so bizarre.
I mean, I think now that we've been through the cycle enough times that filmmakers are aware of what that deal means for them.
Mm-hmm. Aaron Martin Scorsese, Netflix is going to treat you real well, but if you're not.
Right. So it's a different equation for different folks, and you know, thank goodness we're all still. I mean, thank goodness because COVID put a few spanners in the works too, right? In terms of will the theatrical marketplace ever come back? If you're a filmmaker, the decision during COVID or even just after COVID, when we were still trying to open back up, was will anyone actually go, you know? Mm-hmm. And I felt for the first time this year, first time this year that the marketplace for independent art house movies really did start coming back.
So that mid-budget film, I mean, it thankfully did not turn into people that are going to get used to watching them on streaming. And then...
Yeah, American Fiction, Holdovers, you know, there's a number of movies. Anatomy of the Fall, smaller, but still, you know, a decent growth mainly English, but kind of an international movie. You're starting to see like the real shoots of this coming back. I'm so relieved by that because I think the conversation with filmmakers is now very different. But COVID, you know, pre-COVID and the sort of like streaming arms race to overpay or to pay a lot of money for these movies mm-hmm. was difficult for us. Then COVID was really challenging, and getting out of COVID and having theatrical come back took some time. And I feel like this year, at least the audience is coming back and seeing these movies and willing to engage more. And you know what that means? That means they're seeing trailers, they're seeing art, mm-hmm. they're having conversations about what movies are coming up. It's just a much healthier build.
And that was Rebecca Keary, the EVP and head of international distribution over at Searchlight Pictures, joining my colleague Rebecca Polly in a very interesting interview going over her career and the current state of specialty programming and distribution. Thank you so much to both Rebeccas, and thank you to my colleague Chad Kenrick earlier in this episode for joining us in this conversation. We'll be back once again bright and early tomorrow morning with another fresh new episode that we will be recording from Las Vegas. New episodes of the Box Office Podcast at CinemaCon coming to you daily, every single morning. So don't forget to rate, don't forget to subscribe, and you can listen to everything going on here from CinemaCon 2024. On behalf of Rebecca, Chad, and myself, thank you so much for listening, and we'll talk to you again tomorrow morning.